The weekend of the 3rd to the 7th of November 1978 has been a great weekend for St. Andrew's United Reformed Church, Blackwater Road, Eastbourne, for the church celebrated with great joy and thanksgiving its centenary. And what follows is a short historical account of those 100 years. How did the story begin? In 1874, the Reverend John Greener met a Scottish soldier near the redoubt and asked him, "Is there any Presbyterian place of worship in the town?" And the sergeant answered, "No, sir, but there should be. Many of us would like it," and made the offer of a room for a service in his house. Soldiers, fisher folk, Scottish families on holiday, and others crowded into that room until it was too small. The ordnance yard and the barrack field also became too small, and the services were transferred to Diplock's assembly rooms. In 1876, a memorial was sent to the London Presbytery, signed by 83 persons resident in Eastbourne, meeting for fellowship for some time under the ministry of the Reverend John Greener, a congregational minister originally, and late of Maidstone, asking to be recognized as a preaching station. But for some reason, this request was turned down that year. But in 1877, the Eastbourne Presbyterian congregation was granted the status of a preaching station. And in August of that year, the Reverend Dr. McEwen of Clapham, moderator of the interim session, formally opened it. And so we come to episode one, under the Reverend Hugh Carruthers Wilson. Having raised Eastbourne to a sanctioned charge in July 1878, the Presbytery inducted the Reverend H. C. Wilson as minister on the 1st of August, establishing an interim session of three able men from London, George Barclay Bruce, A. J. Malcolm, and James Goodman. These men gave valuable practical and financial help to the new congregation as it struggled to stand on its own feet. A building fund was immediately launched, a freehold site in Cornfield Lane and Blackwater Road, with the goodwill of the Duke of Devonshire, was obtained, and for 3 months a lecture hall with seats for 130 was available for services. By November 1878, the main church building was completed at a cost of £6,200, and on the 7th of November it was formally opened and set apart for worship by Dr. McEwen in the name of the London Presbytery. At first the church was called Holyrood, but soon took the name St. Andrew's. An organ was given by Mr. G.B. Bruce, and it was first of all placed in the transept gallery. The opening services were well attended, and collections amounted to £106. The first St. Andrew's session was formed in 1883, with Mr. F. Staines as a session clerk. A large debt had still to be repaid. But it is evidence of the generosity of the congregation right from the beginning that the minister was voted a stipend of £500 per year. Membership gradually increased, and at one time reached 260. Indeed, the church was quite often full. Mr. Wilson was a great orator of quite remarkable personality, and as he spoke to his people, he walked in the aisles. However, he had indifferent health, and the session minutes indicate that not all was well in relations between leaders of the church. Session meetings became spasmodic. Jobs that ought to have been done were never done. Organists came and went. Perhaps we can read between the lines of a minute from the session dated the 1st of January 1898. It says, "The session accepted the clerk's resignation, but expressed regret that he had not resigned at an earlier date than the 29th of December." Then later in the year, the only reference to the departure of the minister is a single sentence in the session minutes. "The Reverend H. C. Wilson agreed to take the communion service on Sunday evening as it would be his last appearance as minister of the church. On the 13th of December 1898, Mr. Wilson resigned. The membership had dropped to the number it was at the beginning, something over 100, and there was still a debt of £2,700. Nevertheless, the congregation gave him as a farewell present £800 and paid his premium to the Widows and Orphans Fund. He died 11 years later, but it's good to report a word from the session minutes in 1901, which says, "Mr. Wilson, after having founded and built the church at Gravesend, came to Eastbourne when it was a newborn charge. After nearly 20 years of faithful labor, he resigned in enfeebled health. After an interval of 2.5 years, he preached again in his old church a fortnight ago. The congregations at both services were delighted, as in former days, with the brightness and incisiveness of his preaching." Episode 2, The Reverend Robert Calder Gillie. The man who was to halt the decline and begin a remarkable expansion in the life of St. Andrews was the Reverend R.C. Gillie, the minister of Willesden, London. Before that, he had been assistant to the famous the Reverend Dr. John Watson of Sefton Park, Liverpool, in which church he had met the woman who was to be his wife. He arrived in the summer of 1899, and it was at once obvious to all, as someone wrote of him years later, that he had all the gifts and all the graces. Reading the record of his first session meeting, one sees immediately the more businesslike approach. By the time he left to be married in the autumn, a new organ had been placed in front of the central pulpit and dedicated at the cost of £2,000. New hymn books were in use, and an address by a foreign missions deputy had been arranged for December. By the end of 1902, the membership had risen to 282. The presbytery visitors report to the session, "The presbytery rejoices to know that the work of our church is being so ably and effectively done in this important health resort, and that the congregation attracts to itself in increasing numbers not only the visitors, but also the permanent residents." The debt was cleared off in 3 years. A good magazine was issued. The Women's Missionary Association had begun in 1900 and was flourishing. On Sunday afternoons, a men's own was held, with the attendance reaching 150, and aimed mainly at non-churchgoers. Mr. Gillie began to take a great interest in mission work at Hampden Park, and obtained permission to use the women's mess room at the laundry. The men's at 5 Burlington Place began to play a prominent part in church activities. Mrs. Gillie, in addition to running a home and seeing to the needs of 3 children, organized a girls' guild with a musical and literary emphasis. A social service study circle was begun to look at the social implications of the Christian gospel, and of those who attended, not all were Presbyterians. One wonders if this group originated the signing of petitions against the education bill and against barmaids serving intoxicating liquor. And then, around this time, the session objects to announcements from the pulpit of a non-religious nature. Perhaps Mr. Gillie was confronted by the perennial cry, "Politics and religion don't mix." Both Mr. and Mrs. Gillie meant a great deal to the cultural life of Eastbourne before the advent of radio and television, the modern theatre, and the Ashwood Circle. Mr. Gillie gave lectures on a variety of subjects in the town and instructed men in public speaking. Mrs. Gillie took groups through Browning and Shakespeare. Towards the end of his ministry, Mr. Gillie accomplished a very significant task. The purchase of the freehold in Cornfield Lane adjoining the church at the cost of £1,100. Such an extension of the church premises was going to be needed, as the membership after 10 years was over 500. In 1910 came the call to Marylebone Church, which had fallen on lean times. It was a challenge, but the kind that a hard-working, dynamic, eloquent minister such as Mr. Gilley would respond to. He was already well known in the wider church, and he had been in demand as a missioner at St. Leonard's, Ramsgate, Nottingham and Bristol, while at Eastbourne. His great abilities would be used to expand the work at Marylebone, and he would go on to become a Doctor of Civil Law and moderator of the General Assembly. During the ministries of the Reverends J.G. Gould and Dr. Reed, he made many return visits to Eastbourne, where he was received with great joy and warmth. Episode 3, The Reverend James G. Gould. The Reverend J.G. Gould was the minister of Egremont Church, Wallasey, which was built during his ministry. He met the session and managers of St. Andrew's on the 6th of June, 1910, and was inducted at Eastbourne on the 12th of October, 1910. Between these two dates was a period of tension and intense activity. The call from Eastbourne went via the London South Presbytery to Liverpool Presbytery, and there it was halted. Liverpool refused to put the call in Mr. Gould's hands. St. Andrew's remained insistent, and a deputation appeared at the Liverpool Presbytery. Mr. Gould was not well enough to attend, and by letter he said he would be prepared to accept the call. Liverpool eventually agreed. However, on his doctor's orders, Mr. Gould had to take a long rest, and it was well into the autumn before he came south. Soon after the move, he and his family took up residence in the present manse, 7 Dittons Road. The house had been brought primarily through the generosity of two ladies, Miss Williams and Miss Wilson. For the third time, St. Andrew's had a powerful and inspiring preacher. Many members would have heard Mr. Gould a few years before. Mr. Gilley had exchanged pulpits with him, and it is recorded that he was one of the most foremost preachers in the church. So it is no surprise to read of the early overcrowding of the church. However, he was more than a preacher. He had great ability in business and administrative matters. He had first to put the finances on sound footing. He did this by introducing the schedule of contributions, by which people were given the opportunity to promise certain amounts for the main funds of St. Andrew's and the wider church. It was an immediate success. Second, he had to do something about the improvement of the buildings, beautifying the church and expanding the hall accommodation. In the Church Magazine of March 1911, he wrote about improving the church with these words: "We can never make it exactly a cathedral, but if we were to carry out the architect's original design and throw out a chancel where the organ now is, we should gain air space, which we badly need. We should gain seating accommodation, and we should secure a more worshipful building. If we build the chancel, we can at least make that beautiful. A chancel handsomely furnished in carved oak, with a traceried window, filled with rich stained glass, would make our church a very different place from what it is today." He obviously convinced the congregation about church and falls, for by the 11th of January 1913, £4,552 had been promised towards the cost. The new halls on the adjoining site were built, and a caretaker's flat was put in the southeast corner of the church, costing £110. The chancel was, in his words, thrown out, and the Burne Jones window depicting the Nativity, the Crucifixion, and the Ascension was placed there in memory of Mr. D. MacKinnon. The communion table was given by Mrs. MacGregor, the font by Mr. George Brown and his family, and the oak pulpit by the Ladies' Sewing Guild. The lectern and three central communion chairs were given in memory of Lieutenant General Sir Thomas and Lady Galway by their children. The organ was removed from the front centre of the church, remodelled, and then placed in the new organ chamber behind the north wall of the chancel. The choir were therefore able to move to new choir pews in the chancel, and there was room in the front of the church for 50 more seats. On the 26th of November 1913, the church and halls were reopened. The remodeled organ was heard for the first time on the 21st of the next month. The entire cost of £5,450 had been met by the generous giving of the congregation, which at the end of Mr. Gould's ministry numbered 525. So much had been accomplished in so short a time, yet almost immediately Mr. Gould was to receive a call. The attraction of Scotland was too much for him. He had already turned down Claremont Church, Glasgow, when he received a call from North Morningside United Free Church, Edinburgh, his university city. He believed there would be more scope for his talents in a larger setting. On the 18th of October 1914, his farewell services took place, and St. Andrew said goodbye to a devoted minister, a warm-hearted friend of his people, who preached the gospel of Christ with scholarly power. By the time Mr. Gould left, the First World War had begun. Military services were held in the church, and the halls were used as a medical center. And sadly, 18 of St. Andrew's young men would be killed. Episode 4, The Reverend James Reed. A delegation of three went from St. Andrew's to Sherwood United Free Church, Paisley, to hear Mr. Reed. They were delighted by what they heard and saw. He accepted the invitation to preach, received the call, and his induction took place on the 25th of April, 1915. Very soon, the church, week by week, filled up with people, and the life of the congregation began to be stirred. Mrs. Reed initiated the Women's Guild of Service, which aimed at fellowship and money-raising, and marrying the home and overseas missionary concerns. A Young People's Fellowship replaced the clan of Mr. Gould's day. A literary society began its successful programs, led by Mr. Hermitage. There were women on the board of managers in 1918, but none on the session until 1925. In that year, three were ordained to the eldership, Miss J. Galway, Mrs. T. Lloyd, and Miss I. D. Mackenzie. The membership of the church increased, and by 1928, it stood at 623. In 1928, there took place the 50th anniversary of the church. The celebrations began on Sunday, the 21st of October, when both services were conducted by Mr. Reed. In the morning, the mayor, Councillor Miss Alice Hudson, a member of the church, brought aldermen and councillors for a civic service. The following Wednesday, there was a family party at the town hall, and someone reported it was just a lovely jumble of greetings and music and chatter from the moment of our reception by Mr. and Mrs. Reed. Such a crowd was there. The mayor was the chairman, and most of the denominations were represented on the platform. Canon Streatfield, Vicar of Eastbourne, the Reverend W. MacFadyen Scott of Upperton Church, representing the Free Churches, the Right Honourable Sir Donald MacLean, an elder of Marylebone, the Reverend Dr. R. C. Gilley, the Reverend Dr. J. Hutton. There was also present Mrs. Douglas, in whose house the first Presbyterian service in Eastbourne took place. The celebrations concluded the following Sunday, when Dr. Gilley conducted both services. Both before and after the Jubilee, Mr. Reed was given long periods of absence because of his health. He was a preacher of worldwide fame, but for many years carried on his ministry hindered by almost complete blindness. He relied greatly on people reading the lessons in church and reading to him in his study. Nevertheless, the freshness of his preaching was unimpaired, and Reed of Eastbourne received national recognition. In 1930, there was the first of many BBC broadcasts from the church. In 1932, he was the president of the National Free Church Federal Council. In 1933, the degree of Doctor of Divinity was conferred on him by his own university, Edinburgh. And in 1935, he was the moderator of the General Assembly. He wrote many books and a weekly article in the British Weekly. He spoke at conferences in the United States, delivered the Warwick Lectures on Preaching in Scotland, preached in churches and cathedrals throughout Britain, including Westminster Abbey. And yet, he still remained an effective local pastor and continually sought ways of improving the life and fabric of his own church. The managers had acquired property next to the church, fronting Wish Road, consisting of a house and stable. In 1937, it was therefore possible to make internal improvements to the halls. A new vestibule was built near the minister's vestry. In place of the former coach house and harness room, there was a new choir room and kitchen, while the quarters above became a caretaker's flat. Meanwhile, improvements to the church building were not forgotten. In 1934, Dr. A. E. Rook had given the west window in memory of his sister. The pulpit was moved towards the north transept, necessitating a new exit under the north gallery. Congregations in those days were large, and queues of visitors before services became usual. On special Sundays, people sat on the chancel steps, in the vestibules, and in the halls to which the services were relayed. Then came the Second World War in 1939, and the situation changed almost overnight. The windows of the church were blacked out. The halls were taken over by the authorities. Young people were called up. Members were evacuated because of the bombing. In October 1940, it was reported that the morning congregation was down to 125 and the evening to 80. Dr. Reed remained at work in this dangerous situation, though he moved from Ditton's Road to the more safe Denton Road at one point. He encouraged elders to retain contact with people in the forces and with the evacuees. He ministered to what was left of the congregation and the military who were stationed in the town. Socials for soldiers were organized and run mainly by the Young People's Fellowship. In March and April 1943, air raids damaged the church and the west window was destroyed. Although it was replaced after the war, the original design having been found. Dr. Reed had intended to retire in 1942 at the age of 65, but he remained until the end of the war. In 1945, the freedom of the borough was conferred on him in recognition of all that he had done for the town over 30 years, and then he retired to Little Common, Bexhill. Eventually, after the new minister had settled in, he moved back into Eastbourne. On the 19th of July, 1963, he died. He had meant so much to St. Andrews and the wider Christian community. A simple memorial plaque near the pulpit pays tribute to him in the three final words, preacher, writer, pastor. His family and friends, through a memorial fund, established the James Reed Memorial Lecture on Preaching at Westminster College, Cambridge. The first lecture was delivered by the Reverend Dr. Leslie Newbegin, who, as moderator of the General Assembly, was a preacher at our centenary celebration last weekend. We now come to Episode 5, The Reverend Geoffrey Turner Bellhouse. The man who replaced Dr. Reed was already a proven and well-known minister who had been called to Regent Square Church, London, in 1926 and Westbourne Church, Glasgow, in 1938. Mr. Bellhouse was inducted on the 31st of October 1945. Some of the congregation remembered him, for he had conducted worship on two Sundays in August 1938. He also knew what the church was like before the war, for he and his family had had holidays at Seaford and worshipped at St. Andrews. It was a most difficult task that confronted him in trying to build up the congregation. Though the membership total was 530, there had been many deaths and many removals because of the enforced mobility of the war years. Church going had declined, and the loyalty of members had been weakened by wartime experiences. Following the great Dr. Reed added to the difficulties. However, Mr. Bellhouse was an excellent preacher with a liturgical sensitivity, and St. Andrews was soon well filled on Sundays. His friendly spirit and wide-ranging interests brought him into contact with many people, and the weekly activities received new life. The membership of the church was 574 by 1958, reaching a peak of 608 by 1965. The children's church numbers rose from 11 to 133 by 1958. Guides and brownies, scouts and cubs flourished. There was a comfortably filled lower hall for the midweek service, and the church fellowship, aiming at education and entertainment, had a membership of 221. As always, the Women's Guild of Service and the choir did excellent work. St. Andrews at that time took a great interest in the wider world and in the wider church. The United Nations Association obtained strong support from the minister and members of the congregation. The Eastbourne Council of Churches, affiliated to the British Council of Churches, was formed in 1957, and Mr. Bellhouse played a leading role. The session minutes indicate that assembly reports on a wide range of issues were discussed carefully by elders and congregation. In 1958, Mr. Bellhouse was moderator of the General Assembly. In all these years of activity, Mrs. Lucy Bellhouse had been of enormous help to her husband and the congregation. She was the minister's wife, but many beyond St. Andrews knew her through her books about the caravan children. In 1961 she died, and members felt her passing deeply. A memorial window was added to the south wall of the church by her family and friends. In common with many churches in Britain, St. Andrews began to show a gradual decline towards the end of Mr. Bellhouse's ministry. The numbers in the church and the children's church went down, and the uniformed organizations closed. Yet between 1970 and 72, when the Reverend E.F. Cattermole was assistant minister, with special responsibility for youth and children's work, the Saturday Evening Youth Club expanded considerably. Mr. Cattermole was helped by an excellent band of leaders from the congregation, who coped with numbers up to 200. It was a very useful piece of service, which provided a helpful meeting point for young people from every area of the town. 1972 saw the end of the Presbyterian Church of England, for on the 5th of October, Congregationalists and Presbyterians united to form the United Reformed Church, the first union of two denominations in England since the Reformation. That year saw, too, the end of Mr. Bellhouse's time at St. Andrews on his retirement. On the 17th of October, the congregation said farewell after another long and distinguished ministry. Like Dr. Reed, Mr. Bellhouse reached many people all over the world through his monthly magazine sermon, his books, his speaking engagements. He had great gifts of mind, a splendid command of English, and an enviable memory of incidents and passages in the many books he read. Living still in Eastbourne, he remains always a cheerful and interesting conversationalist, with a friendly and concerned word for all. Episode 6, The Reverend Joseph Edward Mather. Following the Union, St. Andrews was in a much more compact group of United Reformed Churches in the Sussex East District. The Council appointed the Reverend Norman Burney of St. George's Bexhill as interim moderator. It took almost a year to find a minister. On the 6th of May 1973, the Reverend J. Mather, who had been Youth Secretary of the Presbyterian Church of England, and at the time was Minister of St. James's, Alnwick, came as the sole nominee. The congregation unanimously called him, and the induction took place on the 6th of September 1973. Between May and September that year, Mr. J. MacDonald, the works convener, organized the renovation of the manse, and though it was not completed, the Mather family moved in. The congregation were pleased to retain the house which had been the manse since the Reverend J. G. Gould's day. The elders were aware that the situation in the church and the world was very different from that in pre-1939 days, and even in the immediate post-war period, and they were agreed that there needed to be a shift in emphasis in St. Andrew's work. They were therefore quite prepared for change. In five churches, or United Reformed Church, we have a quarterly church meeting attended by over 100 members, having a main topic and minimum business, and breaking into small groups for occasional discussions. In worship, congregational praise and new church praise are used. There is a duplicated order of service which is taken to the housebound each week. Summer family services at 9:30 a.m., Holy Week services of meditation, a Christmas Eve midnight service by candlelight, and variation in the form of evening services have been introduced. We've tried hard to improve the pastoral care of elders and members. We now have 34 elders with smaller, more compact districts, and visitors are available to help if needed. We have made it a priority to be ready with a friendly welcome for a visitor or new resident worshipping with us. We have not always been successful in what we have attempted, but the minister is prepared to experiment and sometimes to fail. A small men's club has begun indoor bowls, but the church fellowship, so successful in the early part of Mr. Dalhouse's ministry, has been closed. The Women's Guild, ably led by Mrs. Mather, is highly successful, having an average attendance of 62. But the youth club, so numerous in Mr. Cattermole's time, gradually declined and is now for the time being closed. The Children's Church has the same problem which has been evident for much of St. Andrew's history, lack of an adequate number of children. The Junior Club, though small, has an enthusiastic group each month, and recently a badminton group was started. In all the experiments and changes, the congregation have supported the minister and elders in a most encouraging way. On the 17th of October 1975, there was a church family party when the upper hall was crowded for two presentations, to Miss I.D. Mackenzie to mark her 50 years' service as an elder of St. Andrews, to Sir Sidney Caffin to mark his 35 years' service as session clerk and church secretary. It was reported later in the magazine that Miss Mackenzie, now aged 95, was the admiration of us all when, disdaining the microphone, she recounted some interesting and amusing memories. Then it was the turn of Sir Sidney to do likewise. A stewardship campaign took place in March 1976, emphasizing five aspects of church membership: worship, prayer, involvement, giving, learning. Elders delivered and collected forms. It was an excellent exercise for both the church and the elders. 300 forms were returned, and we are still reaping the benefit. The project was undertaken because we are convinced that in these days, church membership must mean more. It was almost as though a pillar had been removed from the church when Sir Sidney Capin died on the 26th of September 1976. It seemed the end of an era. His father, P.T. Capin, and he had been session clerk and church secretary for 45 years. The church locally and nationally felt the loss deeply. The memorial service conducted by the minister and assisted by the Reverend A.L. MacArthur, General Secretary of the United Reformed Church, was attended by the mayor and council and representatives of the University of Sussex. Hundreds of friends, church members, and representatives of community bodies packed the church and responded movingly in great thanksgiving and hope. Happily, Lady Catherine and other members of her family are still amongst us, carrying on the great tradition of P.T. Capin and S.M. Capin. The tradition of concern for the wider church has been maintained. Interest in the world church through Dr. Maxwell of Taiwan at the beginning of this century, and through our own Joan Elder, has influenced many people. Men's gift days and women's guild programs, special meetings and services keep up the interest. And our commitment to the Council for World Mission through the Unified Appeal is as strong as ever. Moreover, we managed to raise £1,000 and over each year for the 1% Appeal for World Development, as well as working hard for Christian Aid and the Bible Society. Our relations with other churches continue to grow through the Council of Churches and the Central Group of Churches. Following the example set by our predecessors in the help given to St. Luke's Hampden Park and Willingdon United Free Church, members of St. Andrew's have been to the fore in the building of the new St. Barnabas's United Church and Christian Centre at Langley. We are at the moment continuing and developing a tradition begun in Dr. Reed's time of activities with St. John's Parish Church, Meads. Between 1936 and 1940, there were joint meetings between the office bearers of both churches. Now, as well as having regular pulpit exchanges, we participate in the parish contact scheme for Meads and in joint house groups. St. John's have presented St. Andrew's with a clock for the new vestibule to mark our centenary. We receive it joyfully, as a sign of the closer relationship between the two churches. And so our story for the first 100 years is drawing to an end. The crowds of visitors at worship have gone, but we are still left with a large congregation for these days. The membership stands at 438, and we rejoice in the faithfulness, generosity, and service of so many. Sir Sidney Capin in 1975 said that St. Andrew's as a body of members was stronger than in the days before 1939. He was not given to making rash statements, and his judgment was to be relied upon. If it is still true, then we move into the next 100 years with great hope. We are not facing the beginning of the end, but the end of the beginning. The story that has been told has been largely the story of the ministers. Each minister would want to echo what James Reed said in accepting the call to St. Andrew's at the Presbytery of Paisley. He said, "A church often made a minister what he was." The story of our church is primarily the story of St. Andrew's people. They have supported the ministers strongly and generously, putting great ability and sacrificial service into the administration, pastoral care, and organization of activities. It is the story of ministers' wives who supported their husbands in success and failure and offered leadership of outstanding quality. It is the story of session clerks and church secretaries, Mr. F. Staines, Mr. G. Brown, Mr. B. Bradford, Mr. P. T. Capin, Sir Sidney Capin, Mr. C. R. Hayne. It is a story of organists, Messrs. Ingham, Stevens, Scott Davies, Anscombe, and Miss E. Brown. It is a story of church officers, Messrs. Paris, Norton, Fletcher, Protheroe, Garrard, and Smith. It is a story of men and women who have given great public service to the community. Among them, as mayors of Eastbourne, Miss A. Hudson, Mr. L. McLaughlin, Mr. L. Pyle, Sir Sidney Caffin, Mr. J. B. Coventry, Mr. C. Scott. Most of all, it is a story of ordinary men and women, wealthy and poor, younger and older, able and less able, who have loved our Lord and through good times and bad, remained loyal to his church. This is a story without an ending, for their story is part of the continuing story of the whole people of God.